Unconventional Life, the show where twice a week I interview successful entrepreneurs, artists, creatives, and thought leaders on how they earn their living in non-traditional ways. Each of these individuals are at the top of their game in terms of revenue and reach in their respective industry, living life in the driver's seat beyond what is traditional or predictable. On this show, you will learn how they took the path less traveled, what their revenue model looks like, and why they are prioritizing their passion over their paycheck.
It means living a life of passion and purpose.
And what would it look like if you create it from the ground up?
Everything that's shown up in my business has been a place for me to grow or expand as a human being.
I pretty much get paid to be me.
Very frequently, the exact things you think are against you might be the things that are actually the reason you can make it.
I'm your host, Jewel Schroeder.
If you would like to win this week's prize giveaway from our show guests featuring free access to their online courses, books, and other impactful tools to help you on the path to living an unconventional life, simply subscribe to the podcast on iTunes now and go to unconventionallifeshow.com to let us know you did. You can also get a second entry by leaving us an iTunes review.
Unconventional Life, welcome. This is your host, Jewel Schroeder, tuning in from Boulder, Colorado. We've got an awesome guest joining us from Austin, Texas, Brent Underwood in the house. Brent, are you ready to take us down the path less traveled?
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Awesome. So Brent has kind of got an interesting story, which we'll get into in a little bit, but he is a founding partner at Brass Check, where he has created online marketing campaigns for best-selling authors, over 20 New York Times best-selling authors, Grammy award-winning musicians, and venture-backed startups. But he is also the founder of HK Austin, the number one rated hostel in the US, and now is expanding to actually create another hostel, which is super interesting, balancing the duality of both worlds. But with that being said, Brent, welcome to the show. Super excited to have you on. Fill in any gaps I might have left out and give us a glimpse into your personal life.
Yeah, thanks. No, that covers a lot of it. My days are kind of split between reading books, marketing books, and then hanging out with a lot of different foreigners from all over the world at the hostel. It's a pretty fun life. I think that anytime you get exposed to a lot of different ideas, you know, you can always learn something from everybody. So it's kind of a nice balance between, you know, reading and then kind of like the in-person interactions. Because sometimes we're a remote company, so working, you know, by yourself and independently can be kind of lonely. So I can always walk over to the hostel and interact with, you know, dozens and dozens of people if I need to, which is nice.
I'm so curious about that point too. Like, cause being, you know, a solopreneur, being in the realm of having companies the last 8 years, you do get really lonely behind the computer all the time. And I imagine a lot of our listeners. So it's funny you created another structure and environment to satisfy that via hostel life. So awesome. Well, let's go back in time a little bit because, you know, we love to start and tell our stories here. Just like, where did it start at the beginning? And so for you growing up, did you grow up in Austin? Where did you grow up? And what was it like for you growing up? Were you like kind of by the books kind of kid or were you always a little bit untraditional? Give us a little glimpse.
I grew up in Tampa, Florida, just outside of Tampa. And it was pretty traditional. I was pretty into school. You know, I always did fairly well in school. Both my teachers are parents, so, you know, school was a pretty important thing in the household, I guess. And I guess the entrepreneurial drive, my grandfather, he was always a little bit of an entrepreneur. He had a gas station, and I kind of saw the freedom that that allowed him. You know, he spent a lot of time on the beach in Florida and just kind of seemed to have a lot of things figured out that I think I drew. Maybe not at the time, I didn't think consciously that, you know, that's what I want to do, but it certainly, like, I think impacted me long term. Mm-hmm. And then I went to school at Florida State, and I tried to enroll in their entrepreneurship program. And it was interesting because if you enroll in the entrepreneurship program, they won't allow you to dual register in any other programs. You can't, like, dual major, which I thought was ridiculous. You know, it seemed like that should be the most freedom possible. But I wanted to also get a degree in finance, and so I decided to not do the degree in entrepreneurship, which is probably a great idea, and I did a degree in real estate and finance at Florida State. I graduated on a Saturday from Florida State, and I was ready to kind of like get into it. You know, I was excited to start my career and all this, and that Monday, so 2 days later, I started a job in New York City working. And I thought I was ready for it, but about 2 weeks in, I found out I was not quite ready for the New York City lifestyle and that the real world, I guess, quite yet. And so I took some time off. I traveled. I had studied abroad in Panama previously, so I moved back to Panama with one of my friends that I had studied abroad there with. Our original intention was to kind of get jobs there, learn English, and like, spend a little bit of time down in Panama again. And we had built up enough to survive for a couple months. And we had a little bit different train of thought. You know, he was like, well, why are we going to jump right into a job? Let's at least, you know, like have fun for a couple months, then get a job. And for him, that couple of weeks turned into a couple of months, and then he ran out of money and went home. And then I didn't really want to spend my time in Panama alone. So I traveled back through Central and South America for about another 4 months, just staying in hostels all along the way. And at the time, didn't have any plans to open a hostel. It was just a way to kind of experience a couple of different cultures and do some interesting things before diving back into the quote-unquote real world. And so I came back, moved back in with my parents, decided that I had to get out of there. Didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life, which I think is a common theme for a lot of people, particularly in that age. And so I decided to go back to graduate school because I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life, which is probably the worst reason ever to go back to grad school. You should go to grad school because you do know what you want to do with your life, not because you're trying to figure it out. And so I went back to school at Columbia, New York City. I really wanted a reason to be back in New York. It always kind of drew me to it. So I did my MBA at Columbia. And right afterwards, followed a very similar path again. I worked for about a week and a half at an investment bank up in New York. And again, was just like, I can't, still not ready for this. You know, I had delayed it as long as I could by going back to graduate school, but I still wasn't quite ready. So I again took some money and traveled. I went over to Southeast Asia, spent some time in the kind of typical backpacker trail there. And that's when I came back to Brooklyn. I moved way out into Brooklyn at a very, very cheap apartment. Just my only goal then was to kind of not go back into that type of bank scenario, try to figure out my own path. And, you know, being fresh off travel, hostel was in my mind. And so I decided to open up a hostel in Brooklyn because I saw that there wasn't a lot of affordable accommodation options in Brooklyn. It's very expensive in New York. And so with the guy that I was living with then, we kind of started throwing around ideas, ended up opening up a hostel in Brooklyn, New York. Which was amazing. You know, it took a lot of work, but it was an amazing and kind of like opened up my eyes to kind of doing my own thing and having free control over my lifestyle. I started paying my bills and then some, and that was amazing for a couple of years.
And how old were you at the time that you opened the hostel?
23, I think was how old I was.
Oh, wow. So that was a quick progression of time. So let's go give us the timelines a little bit. So you graduated college, Florida State, had your 2 weeks in New York, traveling. When did you go back to grad school? Give us the timelines.
21 when I graduated, 22 back in school, 23 and some change when I graduated. I was the youngest person in my class at Columbia, and so graduated pretty early out of that. That was another big thing. I think that a lot of times my immaturity, you know, I would look at my classmate and be like, hey, where are we going out tonight? And he's like, I don't understand what you mean. Going home to my wife and kids, and like we're gonna go to bed. And so, I definitely get everything out of the program that you can, and you probably should. I was voted the most absent, which was not a good award that you want to win when you're paying, you know, $100,000 a year to go to a school.
Yeah,
it's not something that you probably should get. So again, I wasn't the best reasons or student while in grad school. And so then coming out, traveling again, yeah, it must have been. Right when I was turning between 23 and 24, that was when the first hostel in New York started. And about a year into that, I had learned that, like, you know, we hired a manager, we hired some staff. It was pretty much running itself. So it was fun, but it wasn't necessarily stimulating anymore. So I was kind of looking for something else to do. And at the time, an author I really looked up to, or I thought was funny at the time, was looking for a research assistant, a guy named Tucker Max. He wrote a book called I Hope They Serve Beer in Hell. And so I reached out to Tucker. I was like, hey, you know, you don't have to pay me. I'd love to come and, like, you know, at least learn what you have going on. I'd love to, like, help out in any way I can. And apparently a bunch of people did that as well, so because you got thousands of responses. Finally, he eventually said, listen, you know, you're just not that good at this. I think you're a pretty good kid, though, so I'll introduce you to my friend. And so he offered to introduce me to his friend, a guy named Ryan Holiday. And at the time, I didn't know who Ryan was. Ryan wasn't very well known at the time, but he was 24 as well, and he was the director of marketing at American Apparel. So I thought, you know, he's obviously doing something right. Mm-hmm. And Ryan had a book coming out called Trust Me, I'm Lying that was about to come out in about 2 months' time. And he said, listen, you know, I can't pay you at the moment, but if you'd like to work with me, I'll teach you everything that I know about marketing, and we can kind of take it from there. And since the hostel had kind of supported my lifestyle going into that, I had flexibility and I saw the opportunity. I was like, wow, this is, you know, an opportunity that I would never have gotten in school, probably learned much more than I ever would there. And so Ryan and I started working together. I helped him out with that book. And now here, 4 years later, we're business partners in a company called Brass Check. And we have, you know, clients ranging from Tony Robbins to Google to Tim Ferriss, Robert Greene, just, you know, tons of amazing people that I looked up to my whole life. And kind of the doors were opened by, you know, kind of that initial reach out to Tucker, then Ryan, and here we are.
Here we are. Nice. So, you know, I want to go back just a little bit. What was it like being your parents? Being like, okay, I'm going to go to school. I'm actually going to try New York City. Nope, I'm going to go travel. No, I'm going to go back to school. And then to actually go through the motions and then be like, and it's going to be a hostel, guys.
Yeah.
What was that like?
It was a little bit tough because, you know, my parents were big on education. And so when I said I was going to go back to Columbia, they were really excited about it. You know, it's a great school. They're very excited. Full support from them on that. I graduated and then worked for a little bit for the investment bank. Again, full support. This is amazing. Then when I kind of quit, that's when the support got less amazing. I moved pretty far out into Brooklyn, like I said, to like a very, very cheap apartment. They kind of were trying to figure out what I was going to do. I ran this hostel idea by them. They didn't really know what a hostel was, which isn't uncommon in the United States, I don't think. And they always saw it as almost like, oh, Brent's going to like explore a different path. It's always a temporary thing, you know, that I was going to find my way and go back to a traditional job. And so, you know, they've always been very supportive and giving me like the ability to try out what I want to try out. And so, you know, 2 months passed and, you know, the dad's like, you know, you've been still looking for jobs. I'm like, no, I think this hostel thing might work out. You know, we're doing pretty good. It's like, all right, well, you should probably still keep looking for jobs. And so they pushed it for about a year until the hostel was doing very well. I wasn't able to be there anymore. And it took them about a year and a half to visit the hostel, but eventually they went there and then they were pretty proud of it. But yeah, it's certainly at the beginning, they saw it as a distraction to kind of the traditional path. And they always wanted me to kind of go and get a more traditional job, whatever that would be.
Totally. I wanted to touch on that because I know a lot of our listeners kind of struggle or have been in that dichotomy themselves. You know, at least on my own path, it was like a year and a half. And one of my first companies was all about girls wearing feathers in their hair. So feather hair extension stuff,
amazing,
which was awesome. But same thing, you know, I'm out of college. My dad's like, so are you going to get a real job? And it took like 2 years and he's like, oh, I think she's an entrepreneur.
Right.
So, you know, how did you, in your story, how did you mitigate some of that? Because I know like for some people, like I wanted my parents' approval. I love my parents. And so I wanted them to support me. But at the same time, like I had to blaze my own path. And so how did you kind of balance that in yourself? And what advice could you give for those that are listening that might be in, you know, a similar dichotomy?
Sure. I think that like I was a little bit fortunate because I knew that kind of graduating from Columbia would buy me a little bit of time, if it would put it that way, you know, because like, you know, everybody's always afraid, whether it's, I think, as parents or as, you know, ourselves, when somebody asks, so what are you doing? Or so what's your son doing? Or what's your daughter doing? If they could say, well, he just graduated from Columbia, that bought, you know, them and me a little bit of time to kind of come up with a better answer than, you know, he's trying some bunk bed thing in Brooklyn. But, you know, I think that I didn't ask for the support ever, which is big. And so, like, during that time when the hostel was getting going, I just did any and everything that I could to, like, support myself financially. I was writing freelance articles on, like, Odesk and just, you know, kind of just, like, doing everything possible just so I wouldn't have to ask for their support financially, just because I felt that, like, you know, at the end of the day, I could say, listen, you know, I'm going to try something. It's important to me. I'm supporting myself financially. If I ever get to the place where I can't support myself financially, maybe it's a more, you know, a bigger discussion that we need to have. But at the moment, let's give it a shot for a couple months at least.
Yeah, totally. So how did you make the decision to reach out to Tucker Max? What were you like? Were you searching something? Were you Googling? Like, give me like the rabbit hole you went down that landed you there.
Sure. So I was looking for something else to do, like stimulating, like I was saying. I knew I was going to like start another hostel at the time. I was pretty content with just one, but I wanted to like, to read a little bit more. I wanted to get to learn some new skill sets. It's always just been something that I didn't feel like I was taught very much at Columbia or anywhere. So I was looking to like reach out. And Tucker, I had followed on Twitter actually. Twitter's kind of what brought it all. And he tweeted out looking for a research assistant. He was working on a book that never kind of came to be. So I reached out, And then he had this, an assistant of his made us go through all these different tests, you know, like do this practice research support, research report about this person. And if it works out, then you'll go to the next step. And I remember there's just like dozen steps and it never seemed serious. I was like, it was a very far shot. I was like, you know, whatever, if it works out, it works out. If it doesn't, not too concerned about it. And then, you know, at the very end, when there's like, a, I guess five people were all kind of like helping me out for a while. I think I wasn't an advantage because, again, I had that baseline of support financially, so I could spend a lot more time on it. I was essentially working full time for free for a period of months, maybe 4 months, particularly between him and Ryan, and, you know, proving that, you know, I really wanted it and that it was something that was important to me, and definitely like trying to provide as much value to them, just not outside things that they assign me, but like, hey, have you guys been checking out this, or you guys should think about this and this different thing. And it certainly has opened up, you know, a tremendous amount of doors. I think, you know, another guy that I was exposed to in that circle is a guy named Charlie Hone. And Charlie wrote a book called Recession Proof Grad that's all about kind of like free work. And I think the free work is very important if you're trying to get your foot in the door. It's kind of a controversial subject. You know, a lot of people will be like, you should never do work for free. But that's ridiculous. If you're like 23 and you're just like chilling at your house for 12 hours a day, like what else are you going to do? You know, like there's not like, you can't go on this like holier than thou ground and be like, I have to get money from my work if you don't have any contacts, you know, and like, that's the position that I was in. And so identifying somebody that, you know, could either introduce you to a lot of different clients or improve your work or expand your portfolio, I think that free work is an amazing thing.
Yeah. Well, I second that. I personally have also worked for free a bunch of times, and I've had a ton of like interns that I've mentored that have gone to be like, you know, super awesome successors. And so, yeah, hands down, super valuable. I know a lot of people talk about this concept though. And what do you think like distinguishes or separates you? Like, for example, you're talking like eventually there were five of us left with the Tucker Max thing. So what do you think kept you in the game, and how did you like maintain and keep your value proposition, or what do you think had you stand out?
Well, cause it's like, I think a lot of times people wait until the busy person has some work, and that's just putting more, like, so somebody will reach out to Tucker and be like, hey, I'll do anything to work for you, man. And then Tucker's got to be like, well, shit, now I have like to think about what I'm going to assign you. and so that's just more work for any busy person. Instead of being like, hey, listen, I see that you're doing this. I think you could do this a little bit better. I'm equipped to do that for you. Why don't I give it a shot? What do you think? And then that's less work on their part and actually benefits them a little bit more. So always just kind of like looking at what they're doing and trying to do some different things a little bit better. Like with Ryan, I'll give you an example. Like when I started working with Ryan and Tucker didn't really play around on Reddit very much. And I was like, you know, I had nothing else to do. I was living in a hostel, so I was on Reddit quite often. And so I was like, hey, we should do some of these like Reddit AMAs. You know, this would be exciting. I'm like, Ryan, I think you get a lot of exposure. Tucker, maybe we should do some things. Maybe at least put your articles around there. And this was like 5 years ago before the AMAs become really big or everything like that. And so just showing them why it would be a good idea. They finally bought in, and it was really big. It like drove a lot of traffic to Ryan's site, some new attention to Tucker and stuff. And so just kind of like coming up with ideas that they might have not thought about on their own that would actually provide real value to them, that was a pretty important thing.
Yeah, I love it. I find that so hot. Like that happens so frequently about being a busy person and then somebody wanting to help. And it's just like just as much time as it would be to tell you, I could just do it myself.
Or even more time, because then they'll come back like, am I doing it right? And you're like, well, no, you're actually not. And so it's become even more time than you planned.
Totally. So tell me how you went from being in that role to then, you know, eventually becoming business partners, you know, with Ryan Holiday, someone that you were in that arrangement with, and then founding this like kick-ass company or being a founding partner of this kick-ass company.
Yeah. So just doing consistently really good work. Again, I was working for free, essentially full time with Ryan and Tucker for no pay for a long time. And then they decided to found a company that was called StoryArk at the time. And I was the first employee at StoryArk just because I had been around the longest. I had proved myself, you know, they didn't want to have to go out and go through the hiring process again and find somebody else. So I was kind of the first employee in this company called StoryArk that grew to be about 14 people. And then when that company was doing really well, and I was kind of doing probably the best work out of the people that were within that company outside of the founding partners. And then that company decided to break away. Tucker and Ryan started to go different paths. And at that time, you know, I just kind of been around. Me and Ryan got along very well. We had formed a personal relationship outside of a professional relationship. We were pretty good friends. We saw eye to eye in a lot of things. And it just made sense to kind of bring me on as a partner creating this new company. And leading up to that, I had learned the skills so well and tried to, like, another big thing is like when I was being taught these skills, you know, Ryan was teaching me these great marketing skills. I wasn't just using them in a vacuum and trying to use them with people that he would assign me. I was reaching out to friends, and like I had a friend that was a musician. He was kind of trying to break through. So I, outside of our work arrangement, I tried to apply the tactics to, you know, this musician, and the musician ended up getting a major record label offers from all the standing major labels in the United States. And so for Ryan, it's like, you know, this guy's not just giving me what he assigns. He's trying to go above and beyond. And so I was applying on things like that. I started bringing in my own clients because I kind of like was going outside of just what was defined to me and trying to do a little bit more all the time.
Totally. So for those marketing geeks, including myself, give us like an example, or like even it could be the musician one, about like a specific marketing tactic and what you did and like how it worked. And preferably one that still you think could be relevant, so someone listening could hear it and then still maybe try to implement it.
Sure. I think that no matter what you do, I think a lot of times people want press attention, but they don't do anything interesting. So it's like if you want press attention, you should probably do something interesting. You know, like if you want to be remarkable, do something remarkable. So a good example, we use the musician client. You know, at the time, there was a site called Tor, and Tor was kind of like the underweb, is where like the Silk Road was, and all these kind of like sketchy sites. So it was kind of like the anonymous browsing history. And when we were working with Young and Sick, that was his name, Nick. You know, we kept his identity anonymous for the first demo they released. We kind of didn't put his face out there, which is a tactic that's been done a lot of music, so that's not necessarily that interesting. But when it came time to release the second song, you know, instead of just putting it up on SoundCloud and hoping for the best, it's like, what is a different media angle that might get looks from different, you know, websites or outlets or different audiences? So we decided to actually release the song down on Tor. Instead of it was just a giant, you know, interesting thing to do. We knew that like thousands of people weren't going to like download Tor to find this anonymous song by this guy that they didn't know, but like screenshotting it creates an interesting story. So you have to put yourself in the shoes of like somebody at Business Insider, right? And eventually a guy at Business Insider ended up writing about the story, and the story got 1.4 million page views for Business Insider. And so I think that tracking back and trying to give a little bit of advice is trying to put yourself, if you are trying to get like media attention, if that's what we're going to go for, putting yourself in the shoes of a blogger at Business Insider, let's say. So the blogger at Business Insider is, you know, judged on page views. So they have a page view quota. Let's call it like 2.5 million page views a month that they have to bring in no matter what happens for Business Insider. And so if you're pitching them and you're like, hey, I'm a musician, I have a cool song, that's not going to get them any page views. They don't see a headline there. There's no hook there. Kind of, they're like, I don't care. But if I'm like, hey, listen, there's this thing called Tor, like, people buy guns on Tor, they buy drugs on Tor, and this guy also happened to release this song on Tor because like he really stands for anonymity and like all this different crazy stuff. That's an more interesting headline. And then, you know, just kind of trying to put yourself in their shoes and think about what their incentives are and creating something that, yeah, is a good story.
Yeah, I love it. I think that's so good. It actually reminds me of one of our guests, Brian Switchko, who has a similar bit with that. I should connect you guys. But for those listening, you guys should also check out Brian's episode. It talks about this as well, too, mostly in the realm of Reddit, which is cool. Yeah. But tell us a little bit, take this a step further to the company you guys run, Brass Check, where, you know, to have clients like, you know, Tony Robbins, Dalai Lama, some of these big names, big books, Grammy winners, etc. How do you guys stay busy? And what is it that has like Arianna Huffington knocking on your door?
I think that like at this point, we have been fortunate with a pretty good track record. You know, that brings us up. We probably turn down 80% of the people that come to us just because we are. Our entire company, there's four partners in the company at this point. One of the partners is a guy named Jimmy Sunny. He was a former managing editor of the Huffington Post. So he knows very much kind of like has his finger on the pulse of the digital world and like what goes viral, what can kind of spread very well. And then another guy named Niels Parker, who's one of the best editors probably alive at this point. And so, you know, combined, we all have a different skill set, and we kind of in-house, we can do everything from editing to kind of like creating content to making sure that content spreads very well. And then I think that at the same time, my three other partners are all authors themselves. They all have best-selling books out. I'm kind of the odd guy with a hostel, which is the way that we set up Brass Check. It's certainly still a company that could be scaled to a much bigger level, but we purposely keep it to the point where we can still all focus on our individual passions at the same time. Like Ryan likes to write books, Jimmy loves to write books, Niels likes to write screenplays and pitch stuff out in Hollywood. And so that's an important thing that we looked at as starting the company. It was kind of like, will this allow us to still pursue our individual passions a little bit more?
Yeah. I think for those listening, just to capture that, it is really important to get clear on like what kind of business you want to start and what the day in and day out looks of that. Because so often people are like, I want to have this big company and it's going to sell out for like $50 million. And then in the day in, day out, like it actually sucks. You know, you're spending all your time doing stuff you hate and you're not really enjoying it anymore. And so what was the process that you did in kind of being like, okay, these are all the partners, these are the skill sets we need, one, to make the company, and two, to be like, this is actually what we want. This is like the experience we want while running the company.
Yeah, it went back to the company that I mentioned before named StoryArk. It became like about 14 people. And then when your goal is, I think the default goal is always to kind of just grow. And then at the end of the day, you create kind of like a monthly payroll that's so enormous that you have to take on clients that you really don't want to work with, ones that make you not happy to get out of bed every day. And so, you know, at that point, when you get to 14 people, it doesn't sound enormous, but it's still a lot of money to kind of a pretty big monthly nut you have to cover every single month. And so we started taking on different clients and projects that we weren't necessarily the most passionate about. And so going into BrassTech, we try to think, you know, we want to wake up every day working on projects that the books that we would read and recommend to friends, and B, that would be excited to work on and proud to kind of like talk about in the future. And so kind of keeping that in mind was kind of the main goal when we started BrassTech. And at this point, you know, there's just four partners and then there's one employee as well. But beyond that, it's just the five of us. So purposely keeping it kind of lean has been our goal from the beginning.
Yeah, awesome. So you said you turned down about 80% of the people that approach you. And so I'm imagining for those listening, I know I'm curious about that. And so what is it about that has you turn them down? And do you ever find yourself like reviewing and evaluating, being like, well, if they only had one or two things, or if they shifted or tweaked that, then it would be a fit. Like, give us your world of that.
Sure. A lot of times it's just because we're already too busy. Sometimes there's clients that we maybe would like to take on, but we still, it's just like a manpower thing. You know, since there's only so few of us in the company, we're sometimes just working on so many other projects at the time. A lot of times they're books that, you know, we don't think that we can have the best impact on. If we don't think that we're going to have a success, then we don't want to take you on because, you know, like we want to for it to be a win all around. So if it's necessary, if it's like a book that's just outside kind of our main lane and we don't think that we have the correct contacts or expertise to really make it a successful book, we won't take it on. Or if just none of us have an interest in maybe the topic of the book, that's another one. It's a very personal thing that, you know, like somebody's going to be taking the lead and diving in and spending a month with every word of that book. And so if somebody doesn't really love the topic or really feel it resonates, then we're not going to take it on as well.
Yeah, love it. So tell me about the hostel a little bit to kind of flip sides. And
sure.
What percent of your time would you say you spend doing BrassTech stuff, and what percent of time is in hostel creating stuff?
At this point, it's probably about 70% BrassTech and 30% hostel, just because the hostel, at this point, we have an amazing manager, you know, shout out to Alejandro, he's the best, and we have some different employees that handle the majority of the day-to-day, and so I can kind of just focus more on, I hate to do like higher level stuff, you know, sometimes whether it's like partnerships with local businesses or content creation or just different things like that. So the majority of the times at BrassTech, or the hostel kind of came about is, I was running the hostel in New York. The hostel in New York, hostels have a lot of different varieties. You know, you have your classic party hostels, you have adventure hostels, you have kind of these hacker hostels that a lot of like, startup people run out in San Francisco. And the one in New York is certainly a party hostel, which sounds entertaining until you live in a party hostel for any period of time, and then you realize it's very exhausting. And so when that one, I shut that one down after about 2 years. BrassTech was taking off. That was providing income again. You know, again, it wasn't one of these things that I quit and I would figure it out from there. Just like when I started at BrassTech with the hostel starting, when I shut down the hostel, BrassTech had kind of made up that gap in income. So I had a nice little way to live every month. And then when I came out into Austin, I wanted to start another one, but I wanted it to be a little bit different. I had gotten a little bit older, so I wanted it to be a little bit different feel and this type of stuff. And interestingly enough, a book that we marketed was a book called How to Travel the World at $50 a Day. It was by a travel writer named Nomadic Matt. Well, that's the name of his site. And Matt at the time, we got along very well. He's like, look, if you ever start another hostel, I have to be involved. You have to let me know. And so when it came time for the Austin one, Austin was a little bit bigger and better and more expensive version of the New York one, certainly. And so, you know, again, just being exposed to all these different interesting people from BrassTech and through the hostel, I was able to kind of combine those. And me and Matt are partners here in this hostel in Austin. and it's worked out pretty great.
That's awesome. So what do you think it takes to start a hostel that like spreads? And actually, before I ask that question, would you say the hostel is more of like your passion project or your passion baby than say Brass Check, or do they both occur in the same vein for you?
Definitely. The hostel is certainly like a passion project. It took us 9 months to get the permits from the city of Austin to open up the hostel. So if I didn't have a passion, I would have quit month one. It was just like the most frustrating process that I've ever gone through. Like, I don't know how many people listening have like gone through like a bureaucracy, like a local government, but it's just a nightmare. You know, just, you just want to bang your head against the wall and just like quit every single day. Hostel is definitely my passion. Just, I love that. I love traveling. I love interacting with different people. And you know, the hostel is a way to travel without really traveling. I don't necessarily have the freedom to jump on a plane and go to Thailand and backpack around as much anymore. But at this point, it's kind of, you know, it's selfish, but all the travelers come to me. So I'm still exposed to kind of that excitement and different perspectives of traveling without ever having to leave the living room, which is kind of a cool thing to do.
Yeah, I love it. So if you could, and if doing the hostel stuff, like you could launch a chain of hostels or do it in a way that was super rewarding and fulfilling, if you could just do that full time and not do Brass Check, would you do that if the economics worked and make sense? Or do you have to have both outlets because they're both satisfying for you?
No, I think that having both is extremely rewarding, something that I always want to have, just because like you think about different ideas with both, and I think they both complement each other. When I'm thinking about problems that we have at a hostel, sometimes they can trigger something that I can apply to Brass Check, and the same with when I'm thinking about Brass Check stuff. And I know with like all of our partners, this is the same thing. We all have kind of two different things going on at Brass Check, and we all kind of see them as like complementing each other. Because some of them are, you know, sometimes the hostel is more rewarding and not as like stimulating, and sometimes Brass Check is the same. And so I think that having the combination of both helps me as a person grow to the best of my ability.
Yeah, I love it. I know a lot of our people are multi-passionate or would identify themselves, myself being included. I'm also like a musician, singer, teach yoga, a bunch of other random creative projects. But how do you stay in your zone of genius in being like multi-passionate? How do you manage the two for your own self? Or does it even occur like challenging, or does it feel kind of effortless in some ways?
At this point, it feels kind of effortless. For a while, I didn't have to kind of almost create a little bit of a schedule in like a physical location. So I don't live at the hostel anymore. I have a house about 4 blocks away. So I would work at my house in the office when I was working on Brass Check stuff, and very concretely like close my laptop and walk to the hostel. And then when I would walk into the walls of the hostel, you know, I'd be focusing on hostel stuff. So I usually work in the morning at my house, do all the Brass Check stuff, have lunch, work a little bit more, and then like take the walk to the hostel. And that walk was almost my like mental, you know, shift into hostile mode. And when I walked out through the doors of that, I wouldn't think very much about Brass Check stuff. I would be kind of like handling the issues at hand there, try to think of different ideas. And that was, I guess, my personal way of doing it.
Yeah, totally. So one more question before we move into the rapid fire round. So you were 24-ish when you started like the world of hostile business. But for someone listening and they're like, okay, Brent, hostels, that could be kind of a cool business model to explore. What do the economics look like? Like, what's the barrier to entry? How does it work? Like, give us like the 2 to 3 minute version of world of hostels from like an economics perspective.
Sure. I think that like, you know, everybody that travels, or not everybody, a lot of people that travel and stay in hostels are always like, I'd love to open up one of these one day. You know, a lot of people are different, say me that. I would say the first thing to do is check with your local zoning permits, you know, going back to that. Because it's one thing to kind of just like think that you're going to find a great space and throw bunk beds into it. The city that you're living in or thinking about opening up in might have different plans. And so before you spend a lot of time and effort and even mental energy thinking about it, I would definitely just at least take a trip down. Your city probably has like a city development office. Just spend an afternoon with them. Talk through them, say what you want to do, ask what zoning overlays might be possible in, and that'll save you a lot of headaches and, you know, like stress about finding the right spot. But once you kind of have that figured out, you know, the cheapest way to get into it, as we did in New York, was to lease initially. You know, you can find a commercial space and lease it. And we were lucky enough, we found a commercial space in New York when we were first starting where they're still doing work on the building itself on the lower level. So the landlord, it always comes down to very personal things with landlords. You want to have a great relationship with your landlord in that circumstance. And since she was still doing work, she gave us a very sweetheart deal on the lease as we were there. But if you do get a deal like that, you have to keep in mind, once she finishes the work, she's not going to give you that sweetheart deal anymore, which was one of the reasons that we packed up shop in New York, because the rent did go up about 3 times. But after that, you just kind of like talk with the city, ask them how many beds you can have per room. You know, just if you've traveled a lot of hostels, try to think about like what you were comfortable in, whether it was like a 6-bed dorm. We don't go above 6 beds in each of the rooms at HK Austin, just because I find beyond that, there's just too many people. And just kind of think about what you really enjoy while you're traveling, what stood out to you. And from there, you know, kind of give an envelope, you should hopefully be able to come up with something pretty fun.
Yeah, I love it. Awesome. Well, hostels from the economic perspective, unconventional life, families. So last part of our show, Brent, this is the rapid fire round. So this is a series of questions that you have no idea that are coming. So are you ready?
I'm ready. Let's do it.
Okay. Question number one. If you could say this is the biggest mistake or the biggest lesson that you think anybody in the marketing industry or those wanting to become like entrepreneurs, digital marketers should learn, what would be the one mistake or what would be the one lesson?
If I think about personal experience, and this is, doesn't just apply to digital marketing, but I would say partners, going into business with friends. I know it's a very cliche thing to say, but in the hostel in New York, I did go into business with a very good friend and it didn't work out. And, you know, years later, we still don't talk. So the warnings that people give you about going into business with friends is a very real warning. And, you know, prior going into that, I would, if you were like, all my friends told me not to do it, but you know, you're going to ignore them. But I would say this, like, very clearly outline what each partner's responsible for on paper, not just in a verbal thing, and have very real consequences if each partner doesn't do each of those responsibilities that are outlined, you know, in writing. That would be on business, digital marketing, regardless. That was probably my biggest lesson that I've had in the last few years.
All right, awesome. Next question. What is one obstacle you've had to overcome in order to find the success that you've had?
If I could cheat, I would say the city of Austin, because they were very difficult in our permitting process. Other than that, I would probably say, yeah, just the approval of parents, like going back to it, it can be difficult when you're trying to branch out into your own thing. Particularly if you've had supportive parents your whole life, it's just kind of like helping them understand that it's really important for you to kind of do things your own way and, get something going.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. Next question. What is one thing that you do daily that you feel contributes to your success? It could be a daily practice. It could be routine. One thing.
Reading. I know that's another kind of generic answer, but like one thing that I love about BrassCheck and being book marketers is it's essentially my job to read. And that's a very fortunate place to be in. And I was never actually like a big reader growing up, even though school was very important. I can't name probably like 5 books that I would read. I always cheat on like, you know, the book reports you're supposed to do just because it wasn't fascinating with me. And it's caught up to me. You know, I think, and I look to people that have read their whole life and I feel it is so far behind. And if I would say anything, I would say allocating a certain percentage of your day to just doing nothing else but reading and viewing reading as your job. It's not something like that you try to squeeze in. That's the big thing that Ryan, my partner, always says. It's not, you know, how did you manage to read today? It's like, what do you mean? That's my job. My job is to read. And I think that it's every person's job to read. And so if you can fit in time for anything, you can certainly fit in some time to read.
Yeah, love it. Okay, sub question on that question. What books would you recommend and what would be a good starting point for those that aren't readers? How much time should they allocate?
Sure. I mean, the amount that you're comfortable with, at least try to sit down for, I would say, 30 minutes. But as far as entry books, you know, if we're talking about digital marketing, you know, I hate to use it, but I think that the best book on digital marketing out there is Ryan's book. It's called Trust Me, I'm Lying, Confessions of a Media Manipulator. It'll just open your eyes to kind of how the internet and bloggers and, you know, marketing works these days and the incentives of all the different parties involved. So I would start with Ryan's book, Trust Me, I'm Lying. I think that's, you know, a fantastic book. I think the book Contagious is amazing as well as far as digital marketing. Just another really, really fascinating book that I would start with. And then as far as just life books, I'm looking at a book on my desk. It's Seneca, The Shortness of Life. I think that's an amazing book that is really solid reminders and something that everybody can get something out of.
Yeah, awesome. All right, next question. What would you say to your 20-year-old self if you could go back in time? What piece of advice would you give him?
Start earlier. I think on everything, you know, like start the business earlier because there's no way to like really learn it until you've gone through it. Like, yes, books are amazing and they're fantastic, but like start earlier. You know, like I always thought that the risks, you know, like nobody's really keeping track of your failures. You know, the thought that what if I try it and I fail is not a big thing. You know, the only thing that got me through pushing to the most recent hostel was like, I wouldn't have been able to live with myself not trying. I would have rather failed than have not tried. So I would start a business earlier if that's what you want to do. I would start reading earlier, regardless of what you want to do. No matter what you want to do, I would just start now. And I mean, like the best day was yesterday, but the second best day is like right now. So that was what I would say.
Yeah, love it. Okay, last question. What does living an unconventional life mean to you?
Freedom, I guess. There's nothing really that can kind of substitute the feeling. I remember when the first hostel finally started to break even and make a little bit money, and like you see it almost tipping to the point, you're always nervous that, you know, maybe I'll have to go back in and go back to the investment bank and put back on the suit again. But that first moment when you can kind of like see over the edge and think, wow, maybe this is something that maybe I'm not going to have to go back into the investment bank. Maybe I am going to be able to kind of like do this on my own terms. That's just the feeling that is the most rewarding feeling that I've had in my life. And so I think, that would be my answer.
So good. Well, Brent, thank you so much for taking the time. Unconventional Life family, thanks for tuning in. Brent, I know you've got another hostel that's in the works. And for those listening that want to either come visit one of your hostels, maybe they're in Austin, or those that just want to find out about Brass Check or what you're up to in the world, how do they hear about you and what do you have next coming up on your plate?
We're very quickly, actually tomorrow I'm going into a surrounding city. The surrounding city is of Austin. We're kind of looking to start our next hostel. So tomorrow I'll be in San Antonio. and then I'll be in Dallas and Houston. But if you want to see our one now, it's called HK Austin. It's hkaustin.com. I like it. A lot of other people like it. For Brass Check, it's just brasscheck.net. And you can kind of see what we're doing up to there.
Yeah, I love it. Well, Brent, thanks for taking the time. Unconventional Life family, thanks for tuning in. Another fabulous episode. We will talk to you all next time.
If you would like to win this week's prize giveaway from our show guests featuring free access to their online courses, books, and other impactful tools to help you on the path to living an unconventional life, simply subscribe to the podcast on iTunes now and go to unconventionallifeshow.com to let us know you did. You can also get a second entry by leaving us an iTunes review.